you, Lord, coming to earth in bodily form and coming to be our Savior and to teach us about love and forgiveness and the way to get to heaven. And we thank you that you didn't stay a child, but that you grew up to fulfill the prophecies as we know it in the Old Testament, and came to teach about love and forgiveness, to let us know what to look forward to in the kingdom to come, and dying for our sins. May you bless this teaching time, our fellowship, and breaking of bread this evening, and be with us this week. Amen.
Well, my wife is also complaining about the cold here in Southern California. Says it's the coldest snap she's experienced in all of her years growing up here. But you know, where I grew up, we didn't call it cold until your spit cracked when it hit the ground. Then we said it was cold. So if you're interested, that happens when it's about 50 below. So your spit will actually freeze before it hits the ground. And that's cold weather. So some of you asked me if I could recommend a book, kind of like String Theory for Dummies. And I actually did find a book. Well, it's not quite for dummies. It's this one here, String Theory in a Nutshell. So that is brand new, just out. It's only 600 pages. So, and it's only 20% equations. Pardon me? Math? Well, I mean, it's tensor calculus, I'm sorry to say. But relativistic nonlinear tensor calculus is the most advanced it ever gets. So, yeah, no problem, right? Actually, there are some pictures. Here's one right here, for example. A little diagram. Oh, the diagram. Let me see if I can find another one. Well, there's not too many in here. Oh, here's one. Here you go. Oh, these are actually pretty ones. So, yeah, right. That shows you how the multi-dimensions work. But it's actually fairly readable, but it's not quite yet String Theory for Dummies. How much does it cost? I didn't look at the price. A book like this, I'm guessing, is going to set you back $40. So, try 70. No, it's not bad. I don't think it's quite that bad. So, anyway, you do need something on string theory. And actually, there are several chapters that you can read quite well. So, some of you are also asking me, where can they get Reasons to Believe products as Christmas gifts for the best possible price? Well, the people at the office want me to tell you, nobody gets them for a cheaper price than right here in the class. This is the best price you'll get anywhere. They've been threatening to raise the prices here to make them compatible, but wiser voices have ruled, and we're going to keep the prices that we have. Okay. Those of you who haven't been with us for a while, what we're doing is going through the creation accounts. I was going to give you a scientific discovery. I'm going to save that. And if we don't get to it, that's fine, because last week we seemed to gobble up most of the class time on the scientific discovery. So we're going to reverse this at this time. We'll start with our Bible study, and if we got time remaining, we'll talk to you about that. And by the way, it seems like this happens every year. The month of December is when the scientific literature just floods with all these discoveries. In fact, I just got the latest issue of the Astrophysical Journal, and it came in at 1,150 pages. And some of the most stunning discoveries of the year were in that issue. By the way, it comes out every 10 days, so it keeps us busy reading. Every 10 days, you get 1,000 pages on the average. So yeah, you learn how to read fast. And there's probably a couple hundred journals in astronomy alone, just to keep you up to date on the discoveries. You know, what's exciting is we live in a day and an age where the knowledge base for some of the science disciplines literally doubles every 4 years, which means 4 years from now we'll know twice as much about the universe as we know today. And so it's really not at all surprising that we're getting all these stunning discoveries that are giving us more evidences for the Christian faith. Well, what we tried to do last week was finish up the creation account we're currently studying. We're going through about 24 creation accounts in the Bible. If you're interested, the next one we're going to launch out on next week will be Psalm 104. And it's one of the more extensive creation accounts in the Bible. Actually, quite a bit more scientific content in Psalm 104 you'll find on the 6 days of creation than you'll see in Genesis 1. You know, Genesis 1 kind of lays out as 6 days, but there are 3 creation accounts that also take you through the 6 days, and Psalm 104 is the most scientifically extensive of all those creation accounts. So we'll be launching that one, but let's see if we can finish off Psalm 65. Almost got there last week, and then we had some questions. And I kind of left you with a teaser last week. But just to bring you up to date, because a lot of you weren't here last week, what we were looking at was how Psalm 65 finishes off. And Psalm 65 is a creation psalm that focuses on the superabundance of God's provision for humanity. How, you know, we can tell that God's behind this whole record of nature because of the way it so abundantly provides for humanity's needs. And as you go from verse 5 forward, it talks about how the earth is filled with all these good things that we can enjoy, particularly the food. And the food exists in superabundance. There's always plenty of food. It seems like no matter how much the human population grows, there is this tremendous surplus of food. And it's not just the quantity of food, it's the variety of the food, the attractiveness of it, the tastefulness of it. Well, we're having a potluck tonight. You know, one of the neat things about a potluck is just wandering around, but don't even put anything in your plate, just wander around and look at it all and smell it all. And, you know, just the way God has provided us with food that we not only can provide for physical needs, but it's something that we enjoy. I mean, why do we get together around food? Food is a means that God has provided to help us enjoy our fellowship with one another and with Him. Now, I'm not saying there's no such thing as starvation and famine, but if you look at the famines throughout the world history and famines that are going on today, you can recognize that those famines are not attributed to God's lack of provision, but rather to human abuse and failure to distribute the food. I mean, if you look at the food supply on the planet today with 6.7 billion people, there's more than enough. You'd be amazed at how much food we human beings waste. Nevertheless, there are people in the Sudan, there are people in North Korea that are literally starving to death. The food is not getting to them. And there's a lot of political problems. I mean, North Korea, the food that we send there, where does it go? It goes to the army leaders. It doesn't get to the people that really need it. It gets siphoned off. That as it be, what we emphasized last week in our study is how Psalm 65 focuses on this provision that God has provided, but also reflects back to Genesis chapter 1. How does Genesis 1 end? It ends with God giving instructions to Adam and Eve and their descendants on how to take care of the planet. And particularly tells Adam and Eve that they are being held responsible by God Himself to personally manage the resources of the entire planet for the benefit not only of themselves, but of all life. So they're in charge. But as we go through these creation accounts, you notice the clues that the text gives us on how to focus that management. And particularly we saw in Psalm 38, and again, that Psalm 38 is one of those creation texts that takes you through all 6 creation days. But if you look at the end of Psalm 38 and the end here, or pardon me, Job 38, and the end here is Psalm 65, notice how it focuses on the water cycle. And the water cycle is really the key to the planet having this tremendous abundance of food. I mean, it talks in Psalm 65 about all this food that we have that God provides in abundance. By the way, Paul brings up this point in Acts 14:17. He says, you know there must be a God, when he was talking to the Greek skeptics, because he says, look at how God has provided food in great abundance. And so you also see it in the New Testament. But the whole point here in Psalm 65 is we have this abundance of food because of the way God has provided for that food through the water cycle. And there's a clue here that if we're to wisely manage the planet for the benefit of all life, one of the first places that we should focus our energies is on the management of the water resources of the planet. And as we mentioned last week, the fact that we humans have failed to manage these water resources really tells us that we have lost a lot of our food growing potential. The potential for the planet to produce food is a lot less because of the mismanagement of water resources by human beings. You know, some of the examples we gave is how the Sahara Desert is about 10 times bigger now than it was when humans began to abuse the North African geography. And likewise, the Gobi Desert today is growing at a fairly rapid pace. But I just heard on a podcast, one of these science podcasts, that the western U.S. is now suffering from Gobi Desert dust. Because of the mismanagement of the Gobi Desert region, the desert is growing, dust storms are now distributing dust, and is beginning to cause health problems here in the western United States. And likewise, Sahara Desert dust is causing health problems. So it's not just affecting the food productivity of that region, it's beginning to affect the health of human beings and other animals. Well, let's read these water cycle texts, and then we'll close off with some of the teaser questions I gave you last week. Okay, what do we have here in Psalm 65? It says, jumping down to verse 9, you care for the land and water it. So God cares for the land by providing water it. You water it and enrich it abundantly. The streams of God are filled with water to provide the people with grain, for so you have ordained it. You drench its furrows and level its ridges. You soften it with showers and bless its crops. You crown the year with your bounty, and your carts overflow with abundance. The grasslands of the desert overflow. The hills are clothed with gladness. The meadows are covered with flocks, and the valleys are mantled with grain. They shout for joy and sing. So you can see all the emphasis here on the water cycle and how it translates into an abundant food supply. Likewise, we see this in Job 38. And let me just read a couple of stanzas from Job 38, starting in verse 25. It says, God, who cuts a channel for the torrents of rain and a path for the thunderstorm, to water a land where no man lives, a desert with no one in it, to satisfy a desolate wasteland and make it sprout with grass. Does the rain have a father? Who fathers the drops of dew? From whose womb comes the ice? Who gives birth to the frost from the heavens, when the waters become hard as stone, when the surface of the deep is frozen? Then let me jump down to verse 34. Can you raise your voice to the clouds and cover yourself with a flood of water? Do you send the lightning bolts on their way? Do they report to you, here we are? Who endowed the heart with wisdom or gave understanding to the mind? Who has the wisdom to count the clouds? And who can tip over the water jars of the heavens when the dust becomes hard and the clods of earth stick together? So with all that focus on the water cycle and the way the text ties it into the production of crops for the benefit of human beings and all life, then clearly this is a clue that this is where we really should begin in trying to wisely manage the planet for the benefit of all life and for the 6.7 billion humans that are now presently looking for food here on this planet. And last week we talked about how it is that the Sahara Desert, which once was the breadbasket of the Roman Empire, I mean, it's really true. In the days of Rome, when the New Testament was written, the Sahara Desert region was where the Roman Empire got all of its grain, and this is where the Roman Empire really began to expand, because these grain ships would go from North Africa into Europe, and the pirates would try to raid those grain ships, and this is what really led to the ascension of Augustus and the spread of the Roman Empire throughout the whole Mediterranean region. And it was all focused on that grain trade. But what happened was that people began to remove the trees, using that for fuel. And when they removed the trees, less rain would fall on the land and the grass would die, the desert would grow. And this has been going on ever since the days of the Roman Empire. In fact, it's such that in the latter half of the 20th century, the Sahara Desert has been getting bigger in a linear fashion by 6 miles per year. Every year, the Sahara Desert marches 6 miles south. And so it's now encroaching on the jungles and beginning to shrink the jungle regions there in Central Africa. Now, it can be reversed. How do you reverse it? You reverse it the way you caused it to come about. Instead of cutting trees down, you begin to plant trees. And as you plant trees, this will affect the respiration, water being sucked up by the trees into the leaves, into the atmosphere, and it begins to change the climate. How do we know that works? Well, we know it works because of what happened in the land of Israel. Before the Jews returned to the land of Israel, the land of Palestine basically was non-productive in terms of agriculture. Nothing was growing there. And when the Israelis began to come in, they said, well, let's see if we can reverse things. And what they did is that they would go into the desert region and they would dig these giant concave holes, and they'd be like 40, 50 meters wide, these holes, and they would plant a tree at the bottom of that concavity. And that would cause a little bit of rain that fell, maybe 2, 3, 4 inches, and it would collect down at the bottom of the hole into the roots of the tree. That would cause the tree to grow. And over the course of 30 years, they've been able to double the rainfall over the entire region of Palestine. So, for example, the Judean Hills, which at one time got less than 10 inches of water per year, now get more than 20 inches of water per year. And some that got 15 now get 30. The desert regions that got only 4 inches of rain now get 8 inches of rain. And as it's such, Israel not only produces enough food to feed the population, but exports food all over Europe, particularly fruit and vegetables. So it can be done. Now, the region of Palestine is relatively a small territory, only about the size of Vancouver Island. On the other hand, the Sahara Desert is much bigger. It's going to take a bigger effort. Yes. Sure. Well, I've been toying with the idea of writing an article on this whole speculation about terraforming Mars. And the plan goes that we could go to Mars and begin to pump powerful greenhouse gases into the atmosphere of Mars. And these are basically tetrachlorides. And, you know, as long as they go up into the upper atmosphere, potentially those tetrachlorides wouldn't harm your breeding patterns. And then once they get the planet warm enough, then you can begin to just, you know, let the collection of comets produce a water supply. And over the course of 100 years, you could have a place that would have an oxygen supply and water. Now, it would cost a lot of money. And they've estimated it would cost in excess of $100 trillion. And my own research on it would indicate that that's grossly underestimated. Probably more like $250 billion would be what it would take. And the real problem is this. It would only terraform Mars for about an 80-year period. After that, you got to spend that $250 billion all over again. And so the question is, well, you know, what could $250 billion per century do to make life better here on planet Earth? Yes. Well, I mean, obviously, it's much cheaper to make the reverse the Sahara Desert and bring it back to the conditions that it was in the days of Caesar Augustus than it would be to terraform Mars. And actually, the heart of the article I'm composing is that it's much cheaper to build an artificial planet than to try to terraform Mars. Yeah, make your own planet. you know, kind of like that Star Wars thing where that, what do they call that thing in the Star Wars? The Death Star, yeah. I'll call it the Light Star, okay? And actually, it's not that far-fetched. The U.S. government, in the days before NASA, actually worked out a proposal to build what they called a city in space. And it was roughly 10 kilometers. It was a cylinder that was 10 miles long and a mile in diameter, and the thing would spin so it would create a gravity that would be the same as what we have here on Earth, and people would live on the inside of the cylinder, and the spinning would push their feet towards the edge of the cylinder. So you'd be, you know, kind of standing upside down, but it actually would work. And the thing was all set up in such a way to produce its own food supply, and everything would be recycled. But there was one fatal flaw in the plan. It assumed that everybody living in this space city would behave accordingly, that there would be no crime and that no sabotage would take place, because the city in space would be extremely sensitive to disturbances that would make the entire vehicle uninhabitable. You know, that's the advantage of planet Earth. It's big enough that the cycles that return nutrients that we need for life, it takes quite a bit to disturb those cycles. So you can tolerate a fair amount of human sin and evil and still have the planet sustaining life. But the smaller you make your little habitat, the less sensitive it would be to those kinds of changes. And by the way, that's one of the critiques I'm offering on Mars, is that you could terraform Mars, but you've got, again, a situation that's very sensitive to any kind of human abuse. The slightest human abuse and the whole project fails, and you don't even get your 80 years where you can sustain things. And so one of the problems with Mars is it's just not massive enough to retain the terraforming for any significant. To get bigger is there's a shortage of fuel there. And so the people live on the edge of the Sahara Desert are always scrounging to find fuel. And so they pick up twigs, they pick up dead grass, they pick up branches of any tree they can find, and they burn it for cooking, to cook their meals. And when you take all the vegetation out of an area, it does affect how much water gets released in the atmosphere, which affects the climate. And so you get a drier situation, and you know, it's a catch-22. Things just get worse and worse. Now, you can reverse it. I mean, I mentioned in the class last week, one thing we could do for the sub-Saharan peoples is give them all the petroleum they want, or kerosene is what they really prefer. Give them all the kerosene they want, give it to them for free, on the condition that they stop removing vegetation from their habitat. And on the condition that they not only stop it, they begin to reverse things by planting grass and planting trees and making sure that they work the geography in such a way where the little water comes out of the sky, goes to the right places, you know, channel the water like the Israelis did 50 years ago in the Negev Desert. Do that and begin to reverse it. Well, there was always the Sahara Desert, but it was kind of like in the southern part of Algeria in the days of the Roman Empire, and you know, there was several hundred miles from the coast of North Africa downward where it was in a very rich farming area. And that's literally where the Roman Empire got all of its grain, was from those North African shores. Well, today it's all desert. If people got serious about it, it's not unrealistic to reverse it at a rate of 6 miles a year. I mean, it's now growing by 6 miles a year. By, you know, doing the opposite of what we've been doing, we should be able to make it retreat by 6 miles a year. And that would begin to change the rainfall patterns in that area. And by the way, we can do the same thing with the Gobi Desert. You know, I went to Mongolia a few years ago, and the thing I noticed about the nation of Mongolia, no matter where you look, there's not a tree to be found. No trees. Well, you take all the trees away, and that will begin to affect whether the grasses can grow. The grasses need some trees around there in order to make sure they've got enough water vapor in the atmosphere that they can be... Well, you know, sin is always a factor, and that's why I recommended the solution... A giveaway of the kerosene. Don't charge any money for it. Well, I mean, they can't eat the kerosene, so presumably if you flood the country with kerosene, they might. That's true. Well, I mean, we got that problem in North Korea. We're sending food to North Korea, but it's not getting to the people that are starving to death. What you've got are people who have tons of grain in their homes and people living just 100 yards away who are starving to death. So, yeah, distribution is the problem. And you do need to have some strong outside interference to make it happen. But, you know, here are all the nations of the world gathering together to try to handle global warming. Well, reversing the course of the Sahara Desert would probably do a lot more than all of this discussion about trading carbon, what do they call it, carbon credits with one another. Well, now you're back to the sin factor. Well, someone said the last time the United Nations was effective was the Korean War. So, and what's really made the United Nations effective is when the significant nations of the world said, look, we're just going to step in and make it happen, like in Kosovo. It wasn't really the UN that fixed Kosovo. It was NATO that came in and then made it work. So something of that nature, where the economic powerhouse nations of the world would say, look, let's get serious about this global warming problem. And one of the easiest things we can do in terms of, you know, bang for the buck would be to take care of the Sahara Desert problem and the Gobi Desert problem. I mean, here we're trying to tell the Chinese to stop increasing their carbon footprint, and that probably isn't going to go very far, but they may be interested in reversing the Gobi Desert. So again, what you do, you play on people's selfish interests. Oh, well, I can get kerosene for free. That's a good thing. Rather than saying, you know, well, stop cutting down the trees. That could happen too. I mean, I'm not claiming to have a solution to this. I'm just throwing out some ideas. But one of the things we talk. Okay, yeah, go ahead. That's right. Right. What they did, like in the Judean Highlands, back when they took over in 1966, was it? 67? The first thing they did when they got control of those Judean highlands was they planted pine trees. It was barren. There weren't any trees on the hills at all. They planted pine trees and just let the pine trees grow for a while, and the rainfall pattern came up, and then they were able to come in with fruit trees. Now, if they planted the fruit trees first, it wouldn't have worked. But they were able to figure out that pine trees were very efficient in this transpiration and would actually change the climate in such a way that they could begin to produce the things that they wanted. Okay. Well, let me cut to the chase on this. There's actually some scripture that tells us that all these good ideas aren't going to work. Okay? There are some great ideas, and we know they can work because the Israelis have shown us it can be done. Now, admittedly, that was on a small scale. We're talking about the Gobi Desert and the Sahara Desert. It's a much bigger scale. And incidentally, this has the benefit of dealing with the global warming problem. Why? Because trees remove carbon dioxide and water from the atmosphere, and they do it big time, much more efficiently than grasslands will. And so if you can, you know, reforestate that area, it will make a significant difference on the greenhouse gases. And in one sense, our own nation, the United States, deserves some credit from the world community because we're one of the very few nations in the world that has more trees on its territory before the Industrial Revolution came about. There's actually more trees in the United States than there was in 1776. And so in that sense, the U.S. is one of the nations, few nations of the world, that's doing something positive about global warming. I mean, the other positive thing we've done is we've exported all our industry to India and China, but of course now they're having a problem pumping all kinds of greenhouse gases. But let me go to Revelation 6 and 8 and just tell you that in terms of what the Bible says about the future, it's basically saying God has given us all the resources to do what we need to do to manage the planet for the benefit of all life, but it is going to fail. Now, I saw two hands, one there, and you got a hand. Okay. Sure. Well, as I say, we know it can work because it worked with the Israelis, and how it worked there is they said, we can make a lot more money on this land if we do things right. Well, likewise, the sub-Saharan nations could become a lot wealthier if they were to do things right. Yeah, you had a point. Well, there's no doubt that the planet is getting warmer. The question is, what's the cause of that global warming? There's also no doubt that we human beings are a significant factor in that global warming. It's still a big debate how significant a factor it is. Most people doing research on it would argue that the human factor is still less than the natural factor. But the human factor is not trivial. It is significant. And you know, what we've been talking about here in the class is that we know that human beings are a significant factor, because if it wasn't for human beings, the Ice Age should have started 5,000 years ago. Yeah. Global warming, in that sense, you might say, isn't bad, because, you know, through our domestication of cows and the way we irrigate our rice fields, starting 8,000 years ago, we were able to successfully delay the onset of the Ice Age. On the other hand, it's just a matter of time before we run out of the resources necessary to stave off the Ice Age. Burning fossil fuels will stave it off another 400 years. After that, the Ice Age will hit, and it will hit hard. So, but, I mean, if you wait 80,000 years, you get another warming trend. I mean, you know, it's been doing that for the last 10 million years. You get 90,000 years of ice and 10,000 years of warm. We've had 15,000 years of warm, which is unusual. Pardon me? Okay, the normal cycle, and by the way, these cycles change with respect to time, because there's, as the Earth orbits around the sun, the tilt of the orbit relative to the solar system plane changes slightly. Likewise, the shape of the orbit changes slightly. And the cycle for the change of the shape of Earth's orbit is 100,000 years. And right now, that's the predominant driving factor in the cycle. But wait about 10 million years, and it'll become the 41,000-year cycle instead of the 100,000-year cycle. But for the past 10 million years, it's been the 100,000-year cycle, which means every 100,000 years, you get an ice age. And the ice age lasts about 90,000 years. And then you get a warm interglacial that lasts about 10,000 years. Well, because of human activity, we've extended that warm interglacial by 5,000 years. And if we're smart, we should be able to extend it for another 1,000 years. At the rate we're burning fossil fuels, we'll only be able to extend it for 400 years. And then the Ice Age will hit. But if we're smart, we can put it off a little longer. Okay. Revelation chapter 6 and 8 tells us that probably we're not looking at 1,000 years for God to bring about the conquest of evil and for Christians to fulfill the Great Commission. It'll probably happen in less time than that, in which case the onset of the next Ice Age, from a biblical perspective, would not be a significant factor. Nevertheless, God has told us that we're to do what we can to make the planet as pleasant as possible for all life. But it tells us in Revelation 6 that all these great ideas and how to keep the planet maximally productive for all life will fail. What it tells us in Revelation 6 is that in the future, human abuse of the planet will lead to four significant consequences. And let me just jump down to the one that's attributed to the black horse. Talks about the white horse and the fiery horse and the black horse and the dappled horse. But the black horse, this is verse 5, it says, "When the Lamb opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, 'Come,' I looked, and there before me was a black horse. Its rider was holding a pair of scales in his hand. Then I heard what sounded like a voice among the four living creatures saying, 'A quart of wheat for a day's wages, and 3 quarts of barley for a day's wages, and do not damage the oil and the wine.'" And so a lot of Bible interpreters have looked at this passage as saying at sometime in the future, in the days just previous to the fulfillment of the Great Commission, there's going to be a worldwide famine that will strike the grain supplies but will not damage the supplies of wine and oil. So that's kind of an interesting idea, that there'd be lots of oil, lots of wine, but not enough grain. But in one sense, we can already see that happening. You know, in my own home country of Canada, which used to be the second biggest wheat exporter in the world, second just behind the United States, has now converted most of its wheat fields into oil fields, in the sense that they're taking wheat out of production and they're producing rapeseed instead, which is where you get canola from. And the whole point is they can make a lot more money on a square mile of rapeseed than they can on a square mile of wheat, and the market is stable. The wheat prices go up and down like crazy, but the oil prices are nice and consistent, because if people don't buy the oil for food, they can always sell the oil to be converted into fuel for, you know, internal combustion engines, for example. And so from an economic perspective, it's smart for a Canadian wheat farmer to take wheat out of production and then make rapeseed. Or likewise, it might be smart to take your wheat fuel out of production and produce grapes instead. Again, the wine market is nice and stable, and you make a lot more money per acre on an acre of grapes than you do an acre of wheat. In fact, you know, the friends I knew in the province of Saskatchewan, they said to make money growing wheat, you have to have 4 square miles of land. If you've got less than 4 square miles of land, you will not be able to turn an adequate profit to support your family. Well, that's a lot of land that you've got to maintain, 4 square miles of land, in order to have enough. And so the problem is the wheat price just varies to such a great degree. Right now, the price of wheat is high, but there's been periods when the price of wheat has been very low. By the way, it's high because of this very problem that land is being taken out of production to make the oil and the wine instead of the grain. And likewise, what's happening here in the United States? We're still growing lots of corn, but the corn, it less and less is being used for food, and more is being used for olive oil, you know, rapeseed oil, nut oil, so palm oil. I mean, what it says in the Bible is oil. So, and I'm interpreting that as a food oil. But food oil is easily convertible into fuel for your automobile engine. In fact, there's a gal at our office, and she is one of these cars, a biodiesel car. And any kind of food oil you can use to power that car, any kind of food oil, doesn't matter. Yeah, matter of fact, she was saying, she's a doctor, a medical doctor, and says, you know, who gets solved two problems at once? Use liposuction waste as fuel for the car. She's joking about that. But right. So in that sense, even in the biblical context, that's not been the case. Yes. Well, this gal in our office, that's what she was doing. She was going to all these fast food places and just getting their oil waste. But she can't buy it anymore. There's a market for that. And so she has to look elsewhere. That's why she was saying maybe liposuction waste is the way to go. Yes. Well, as our colleague, my colleague Fuzz Rana would say, is that really we should be saving all these petroleum resources for the plastics industry. Because you can use food oil for fuel, you can use it for lubricants, but the real problem is the plastics. And if you burn up all your petroleum reserves, then it's going to be much more difficult to make those plastics. Not impossible, you can make them from coal. But it's just much more challenging to make those plastics from coal than it is from petroleum. So, you know, he would advocate, let's save that oil for the plastics industry, because, you know, it's actually possible to conceive of building freeways out of plastics. That could be done. And so we were able to use... So kind of where I'm going with all this is that Revelation 8 kind of takes you to step 2. So Revelation 6... makes the comment that in the future, in the days just previous to the fulfillment of the Great Commission, which, by the way, may not be that far off. As I've mentioned here in the class, in the year 1900, 2.2% of the world's population could be classified as Christians who are committed to fulfilling the Great Commission. And right now that figure stands between 14 and 15% of the world's population. And so there's been a dramatic increase in the missionary effort throughout the world. And based on Zechariah 13, I would argue that the fulfillment of the Great Commission would be that point when one-third of the world's population would fall into that category. Well, that's within reach. It's within technological reach of the Christian community to make that happen within the next decade or two. Now, you know, sin can get in the way and delay that, but, I mean, it is within reach. And so it is possible that these events we read about in Revelation 6 and following could happen in the relatively near future. Now, what Revelation 8 talks about, and again, it's the third. Okay, you got this third angel in Revelation 6. Now I want to talk to you about the third seal, or this that's released in Revelation 8. I do believe the two go together. And this is in verses 10 and 11. It says, "The third angel sounded his trumpet, and a great star blazing like a torch fell from the sky on a third of the rivers and on the springs of water. The name of the star is Wormwood. A third of the waters were turned bitter, and many people died from the waters that had become bitter." Now, as we closed off the class last week, we were talking about, you know, water management for growing food and how there really isn't the pressure today, because right now the agricultural industries of the world are producing more than enough food for everybody. We have a distribution problem. We don't have a food production problem. Even nations like India and China do quite well at feeding their population in spite of their enormous population. But we could easily imagine the Sahara Desert project failing, the Gobi Desert, and that's really much more threatening. As the Gobi Desert gets bigger and bigger, that's going to impinge China's ability to feed its population. And likewise, we can imagine that conditions in India could, you know, reach a tipping point where they begin to have problems feeding their population. And what we mentioned last week is there's actually one last great resource of agricultural productivity available to the world's population. Fresh water supplies poisoning that water and causing a catastrophe for the world's population. And of course, all of you want to know where that was, okay? And I said, well, you got to come back next week. So Lake Superior in Michigan, Lake Baikal in Russia, those are places where a lot of fresh water resides. Likewise, Lake Victoria is a significant source of fresh water. But notice the text here talks about the rivers and the springs. And so kind of what I keyed on here with Revelation chapter 8, where in the world do we find fresh flowing water supplies? So, because, you know, trying to tap Lake Superior and get that water where it could do some good would be quite challenging. But when you're talking springs and rivers, now you've got something that's technologically less challenging to bring about. So looking at a globe, where do we find fresh water flowing supplies? Well, an obvious answer is the Amazon River. The Amazon River has the greatest water flow of any river in the world, but it's just one river. And actually, you get a more significant, by the way, it, you know, in terms of a star hitting the Amazon Valley, it's not going to do much, because, sure, that river has a huge water flow, but that water comes from a very large area, basically the whole of Brazil and Peru, Ecuador, Colombia, Venezuela, a few other nations in that area, Bolivia. Huge water area. And so if an asteroid were to strike South America, how could it damage one-third of the world's freshwater supply? And by the way, the Amazon does not add up to a third. It falls short of a third, even though it is the largest flowing river in the world. However, you look at North America, you can find a place where, amazingly enough, you get one-third of the world's freshwater, all coming from a very tiny geographical region. And it's a spot on the North American continent where seven of the greatest rivers in the world flow. Now, they're not long rivers, but they're great rivers in terms of the amount of water flowing in those rivers. For example, the river that places second in the world comes out of that region. The river that places fourth in the world comes out of that region. Okay, hopefully I've raised enough curiosity here that you're trying to figure what's going on. Something else I can kind of talk to you about that this may be coming in the relatively near future. If you look at drought cycles over the last, 5,000 years, and I need to bring this book and show you, but there's a book on climate cycles I read, literally 30 years ago. And what it does is it looks at the past 5,000 years and demonstrates that there's a 170-year drought cycle that strikes the planet. So in other words, you get every 170 years about a decade worth of exceptionally dry conditions that, you know, affects the whole of the planet. But every third one of those is a super drought. So every 510 years, the planet is hit with a super drought. And you say, well, when did the last peak of the 510 years happen? Well, a little bit less than 500 years ago, which means we should be coming up on another one of these super droughts. And the super drought, by the way, is about five times more devastating than the 170-year droughts that we get. And so if there were to be one of these super droughts to hit the planet again, that would put a lot of pressure on North America to put the whole world to grow food, much more food than we're growing now. North America is it. You're not going to increase the production of Asia by very much. Europe is saturated. Australia is saturated, unless you could find some way to water the desert of Australia, and we have no water supply that's easy to get to turn that into arable land. But in North America, you've got lots of water and lots of land that could be turned into cultivation. Okay. Now, here's a little map I can show you. These are the rivers of the Northwest. And what you notice here is that you have seven of the world's greatest rivers in terms of water flow coming out of a relatively small region. Now you say, what's the one that ranks second? It's the Mackenzie. The Mackenzie River, which comes out of this region here, flows north into the Arctic. Have any of you have been to the Athabasca ice fields in Banff and Jasper? That feeds into the Mackenzie River. That water goes north. And right now, not a drop of that water is exploited. None of that water is used for water power. None of that water is used for agriculture. All that water, in the words of several Canadians, flows untasted, wasted into the Arctic. Nobody's used. That's completely unexploited. Okay, the river that ranks fourth in the world is the Fraser River. And that's this little river right here that goes up like this and comes out by Vancouver. And again, that's a water that's not used for agricultural purposes. And it's not even used for water power. British Columbia is getting all the water power it needs from the Columbia. It does use the Columbia for water. And it uses a couple of small rivers along the coast here for water power. But the Fraser is not touched. So those are two great unexploited rivers, not used for agriculture, not used for power. The Columbia, it ranks in this region of great water flow rivers, but others you may not have heard of, the Saskatchewan River. Ever heard of the Saskatchewan River? It's actually one of the longest rivers in the world. It flows from the Alberta Rockies. This is the North Saskatchewan, and this is the South Saskatchewan. And the Saskatchewan eventually makes it into the Hudson's Bay. Now, the Saskatchewan rivers are used for agricultural purposes, but they're only used to help irrigate the Canadian prairies. The water does not get exported to the U.S., and it really isn't being fully exploited for Canadian farmlands either. Canada could easily quadruple its food productivity if it were to properly exploit the Saskatchewan rivers, but that's not done. Now, rivers you probably have not heard of are the Skeena and the Stikine. Ever heard of those rivers? They're actually gigantic rivers, but quite short. The Skeena flows into Prince Rupert. So this is the Skeena right here, and the Stikine goes through British Columbia and comes out just at the bottom of the border between Alaska and British Columbia. But they're enormous rivers in terms of water flow. At the mouth, they're several miles wide. They look like the Mississippi in terms of water flow. Now, way back in 1958, when there was quite a bit of worldwide famine. There was a Swedish consortium that negotiated a deal between the United States and Canada to actually capture this water for agricultural purposes. And the plan, I'm going to try to overlay this. It was called the Rocky Mountain Trench Project. And at that time, it was estimated it could be achieved for the modest sum of $100 billion. Of course, that was 1958 dollars, so it'd be over $1 trillion to do it today. And there was actually some serious movement in both the Canadian government and the American government to do this. Now, the reason why it was never put into effect is that the food crisis that the world was facing back in the late 1950s was resolved through better use of a fertilizer and through exploiting agricultural lands that hadn't been exploited before. The Green Revolution. The Green Revolution basically tripled the productivity of existing farmlands, and therefore there was no need for this Rocky Mountain Trench project. The other reason why it didn't go through is that the Canadian government was a little bit concerned that if they stored all this water and there was a massive earthquake in that part of the Canadian Rockies, it could do a lot of damage to the provinces of British Columbia and Alberta. But the plan was basically to dam up the sources of these big rivers and form these trenches where they would store huge quantities of water. And the phase one of the plan would be just to capture the water from four rivers. And that was phase A, which is this one. Phase B would be to make a second trench where you would not only capture the Skeena and the Stikine, you'd also capture the water from the Yukon River. The Yukon flows through the Yukon, through Alaska, and comes out in the Bering Strait. It's also one of these really big rivers in terms of water flow. And by the way, the water is greater now that we have global warming, because the melting of ice in that region is causing those rivers to be even more productive in terms of water flow than they were before. So with these trenches put into place, and the $100 billion was for both trenches, it's quite a bit cheaper if you only go for phase A. And then the plan is to send the water into the desert states of the United States, but also to increase the productivity of the Canadian prairies. And so it would be used to irrigate fully the prairies of Canada and the United States, and it would turn Utah and Arizona, the deserts of California, the desert regions of Oregon, New Mexico, all this would be turned into rich farmland, and now the nations of the world would have all the grain they would need. Or if the price of oil keeps going up, they could say we can turn this all into corn productivity, and therefore we can now, instead of using this for food, we would use it to power all of our... Well, okay, this is a speculation I'm offering, that for Revelation 8 to be fulfilled, there would have to be some pressure on the world to dramatically increase its food supply. Therefore, the water would be tapped. Because right now, if an asteroid hit that region, it wouldn't do that much damage because the water is not being exploited anyway. Or, I mean, you keep supporting Reasons to Believe and other evangelistic ministries, maybe we'll fulfill the Great Commission a little more rapidly than you might think. These events might happen in a shorter time period. I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that I could survive to see all these things be fulfilled. That could happen. So, and you know, the reason why God tells all of this in Scripture, so when the events do happen, that we can use these as signals to guide us in our evangelistic efforts. The whole point is, such a project, if it were to be undertaken, would set the stage for the fulfillment of Revelation 8. Without this kind of a project in place or something similar to it, I don't see how that prophecy could be fulfilled. You know, how could you poison one-third of the world's fresh water where it would actually impact human civilization unless that water is being exploited? And so as long as the water is not exploited, it won't happen. and that water won't be exploited until there's an economic demand for it. Or if you wait too long, all the ice here will melt and there won't be any river water flowing there anyway. So that's another argument that maybe this is going to happen sooner rather than later, but who knows. But again, when I taught the book of Revelation, the whole point is we don't know when these events will be fulfilled, but as we see them being fulfilled, that will guide us in our efforts to bring people to faith in Jesus Christ. Because, you know, obviously people are going to be putting a lot of faith and confidence in this, and when the asteroid comes, then they're going to be looking to put their faith elsewhere. Yes. It's called the Rocky Mountain Trench Project, and I'm trying to think of the name of the Swedish consortium that actually proposed it to U.S. and Canada. The name's not coming to me. But it was actually seriously proposed back in 1958, and it was rejected with the Green Revolution. So the Green Revolution would need to be disturbed. Yeah, they're in British Columbia. No, they're on the western side. In other words, well, what you have here is a range of mountain called the Rockies, which basically divides British Columbia and Alberta. But if you go towards the Pacific Ocean by about 80 to 100 miles, you come into a second range of mountains called the Selkirks and the Purcells. And the plan is to make these gigantic dams between the Selkirks and the Rockies and just create this huge reservoir of water and then use that water, number one, for water power. And therefore, that would take a lot of pressure off of the coal and oil electricity firing plants. You wouldn't need them, because it would be all this electrical power that could be exported. But number two, you'd also export the water. I mean, that was the Swedish plan, is to satisfy power needs for electricity at the same time to satisfy water needs for agriculture. So you can make money both ways. You sell the electricity, and you also sell the water. It would be extremely profitable for the Canadians to do this, if there's a market. But right, you know, what they said back in the 1960s, there's not a market for the electricity and there's not a market for the food. But if that were ever to change, where there would be a market for the electricity, and you know, right now there is a lot of pressure. If we can get our electricity from water, we don't have to burn fossil fuels. Well, there are significant underground. By the way, the Sahara Desert's got a big underground aquifer. You say, you know, because, you know, rain does fall there. It's just that because the trees aren't exploiting that water, it seeps through the soil and goes down deep. And so there's water there that could be exploited, but how much better to change the plant cover of the Sahara Desert? And, yeah, there are aquifers here in the U.S., but basically we're draining our aquifers. The Arizona aquifer, I think, is going down 6 feet per year. So there's going to be, and again, that's extra pressure. If we're draining our aquifers, then there's more incentive to say, well, let's exploit all that water that flows into the Arctic Ocean, into Hudson's Bay, and out through British Columbia and Alaska that no one's using. Let's use that. But I don't think any of this is going to happen until we see the prophecy of Revelation 6 fulfilled, where there's a significant drop in the availability of grain for food and a surplus of oil and wine. So it's great to have lots of oil and wine, but you haven't got grain, that can be really tough. So if for no other reason, it's hard to get hamburgers if you don't have lots of grain, right? Okay. We're out of time. Yes. That's slow? Okay, what have we got? Nah, I got 12:26. Okay. If there are no more questions, I'm going to declare our study of Psalm 65 completed. So next week, we'll jump into Psalm 104. And that's one of my favorite creation texts in the Bible. It's one of the biggest and most extensive. And by the way, it's also a creation text. It's a great place to go to resolve people's fights and disputes. over the interpretation of different creation accounts. And we have to be ready here by 1 o'clock. There's a meeting here, so you're welcome to talk and fellowship, but they want us out of here by 12:45. So you've got 20 minutes to fellowship. After that, you have to fellowship outside, or just come tonight. I mean, we have a potluck tonight, and you're welcome to bring a guest. Just make sure that whatever food you bring is enough to compensate. I'm going to bring a main dish myself, so... Okay, let's bow for prayer. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for the time that you've privileged each one of us to live in human history. Lord, we thank you for this very exciting time in which we get to see so much fulfillment, not only of scientific evidence for your existence, but also we see events in world history that tell us that you're at work, and you're bringing about your purposes to a final conclusion, and that we can look forward to being transfer from this universe to a brand new creation. Father, I pray that you would give us sufficient insight into your word and into the record of nature that we'd be able to effectively communicate with people that don't yet know you as Lord and Savior, that they may come to understand not only your existence, but to receive your light, your truth, life, and love into their hearts, and therefore be enjoined with us in that pursuit of the new creation. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.